Film Nerds Unlimited. Lo-fi movie conversations with high-quality movie connoisseurs. Craig Hamilton of CitizenCraig.com. Ben Stark of Wondermill Films.
Craig.
Yes.
Hey. So, it took a while, but we're going to wrap this thing up. We are discussing the second last of the Harry Potter movies. Not the second to the last, but the second part of the last Harry Potter movie. Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 2, directed by David Yates, for the fifth time?
Yes. Wait, fourth one, time. Two, yeah.
Phoenix, yeah. Half-Blood Prince, Deathly Hallows 1, 2, fourth time. And it's what struck me from the get this time, or not necessarily the beginning of the movie, but just when I ended it, I thought about it, and I was like, you know, this actually, there's a structural similarity here to Deathly Hallows Part 1, where both of these movies, which are the, you know, the falling, or at least the climactic action of the story, they both start with this kind of spy-type adventure episode. You know, the Deathly Hallows Part 1 has an early sequence where they have to get into the Ministry, and then this one has the early sequence where they have to get into Gringotts. And
yeah,
I think this one probably the that action adventure element works a little bit better early on. But I remember in the theater, I was like, "Wow!" After such a dark ending last time, it doesn't take us long at all to get right into a really kind of fun theme park ride, almost as we go into the guts of Gringotts and then have to escape on the dragon and everything.
There is a theme park ride this, I think, actually.
I'm not surprised at all. Yeah, it's certainly an homage to Indiana Jones, the Temple of Doom, and maybe even Donkey Kong Country. But I any sort of minecart action sequence, I am fully on board with, and this one doesn't disappoint.
Yeah, and I thought they did a good job of adapting it from the book. It's They added some stuff that makes it better when you're looking at it instead of reading it, obviously. But yeah, it's pretty right on, and it's sort of funny. There's Ron, as usual, sort of makes it humorous. I remember when they showed his face after they did the transformation, the theater sort of started laughing because it's just sort of a ridiculous looking, you know. Like his features are just so, like caricature-ish almost. So, but yeah, that was like a really serious part in the book. So from here on out, it's like insanely. Well, the whole thing was serious, but yeah, I think they managed to add a little humor to the beginning part of it, and then, yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, I think even through the end battle, you know, when there's so many different layers of action going on, they still do manage to keep a good bit of levity in there in terms of the, I guess, for lack of a better word, sexual tension between Harry and Ron Hermione and Ron. Sorry.
That's another podcast.
That's my side project that I'm working on. Hermione and Ron, and then also Neville has so many great little moments that are played for laughs, but are also totally serious throughout the ending. But yeah, for whatever reason, this one, I guess just because there is that resolution at the end, this one does feel like it has a lot more levity to it than last time. Would you agree? I mean, I guess it's hard to gauge because you're walking out of the theater probably feeling a lot better than you felt last time.
Yeah, that's true. I was mainly just talking about the beginning of the movie, the beginning of this thing where they're going into Gringotts before they actually go down.
Absolutely.
It's sort of just kind of humorous, but then from there on out, it's exposition and just go time. It's you know, they escape, and they get on that dragon, and then immediately they're kind of celebrating for like 2 seconds, and then his scar hurts, and
right.
immediately it's like, and there's like maybe a third, a quarter of the book left, I believe, at that point. It's like not the end. You could use it, you could wrap up from there on out in a few chapters, but there's still a good chunk of the book left, which I thought was really cool. When they ended the first half, or the first part in where they did, you knew after that it was just going to be one, like, wild ride, like one
yeah.
nonstop ride. They're just going to go all in on the big battle and
yeah.
stuff. So.
One thing I really liked about the first Deathly Hallows is how they kind of opened it up and let the drama and the interpersonal stuff really play out. And then in this one, it's just, you know, action beat after action beat, and everything, it's basically, you know, them reacting to everything that was set up in part one. And it's all so satisfying, you know. It feels like you have just the right amount of time to play each of these major dramatic moments, but because you did the work up front, setting everything up, they can happen one after the other without it feeling like you're being robbed of anything, you know? And every character has their little heroic moment or tragic moment, in terms of Snape, in terms of Ron's mother, Neville, like I mentioned. So the construction of these two movies especially, I mean, of the whole franchise is masterful, but of these two movies especially, it's kind of mind-blowing, and that's coming from somebody that hasn't read the book. So, I mean, you know, it all works for me, and I think that alone shows how successful the series is.
How did you feel about the Dumbledore's brother moment where he starts talking about, hey, hold on a second. I'm hearing the fapping sound. So just FYI.
I'm not hearing it at all.
Okay, good. Maybe it just
means
it's on my...
yeah, it probably is just on your end. But if for some...
Okay.
We can redo this if it is. But I think it's probably fine if I'm not hearing it.
Probably. Okay, I just wanted to let you know, just in case you're like, what?
I mean, that's totally the phone, that sound. It's definitely on your end, not my end. Definitely
okay.
100% the phone, not me. Ron. So anyway,
Harry
yeah,
Ron.
Just ignore
okay.
it.
Joining,
where
were
yeah,
we?
So
yeah, so
you're
the
about
Albus's brother and the Ariana Dumbledore, because you know what I'm talking about, where it's sort of a
yeah.
or
I mean that this time. Yeah, this time after seeing Fantastic Beasts, that helped so much. You know, I feel like I have so much more interest in that. I don't remember how I reacted the first time I saw it in the theater. I didn't ask. I didn't do our standard thing where I asked kind of what your mindset was going in. But mine was, I mean, I was pretty hyped for this. I remember taking off work early so that my wife and I could go see it before anybody could spoil it for me, because I was one of the few people that had zero idea how this would all end. But I remember being a little bit confused in the movie, but, you know, having everything, I had enough context to know what was going on. And now that I've seen Fantastic Beasts, I feel like, oh, okay, these movies are only going to get richer, like kind of looking back at them once I get a little bit deeper into the backstory.
Yeah, like when you're watching the book, it's great to have all this extra detail in the book. That's what the fans want, and that's what Rowling's so great at doing, is providing extra detail for this world that she... you know, might have had to cut more from, but we love anything extra. And when you see that in the movie, it's either a nod to, hey, oh yeah, the fans want us to acknowledge that this part was in the movie, because it does add context to Dumbledore. And that's really what, and the movie does it in other ways. It brings in more context to Dumbledore's past. And that's, so it's consistent with that. But I think there's another reason. I think that she totally did that because she knew one day she wanted to expound on his past even more, and I don't know, maybe that's just a 5 or 6 year or 5 year foreshadowing or something, but yeah, it does make a lot more sense after you've seen Fantastic Beasts, even for those that read the book and were in it when it was released. But yeah, that guy, that Dumbledore's brother, had always just been, for the last three, so, oh, I don't know, maybe four or five books even, she mentioned this guy as the bartender at the Hogshead. I mean, this character was in the background of a smattering of scenes, at least since Order of the Phoenix, and possibly even mentioned in Prisoner, or the third or the fourth book. And it's now it's not... that they say, oh, that's Dumbledore's brother. And then Harry's like, I thought he looked just like Dumbledore. And it's, you know, yeah, so it's kind of, there's seeds or, you know, plants are sprouting from seeds sown many books ago. But yeah, and he's got that secret, and also the secret passageway to Hogwarts. There's, since Harry found the Marauders, this is just extra for me, since he found that Marauders map, the map is supposed to have, one of Ron's brothers said, yeah, it has, I forget the exact number, several hidden passageways in and out of Hogwarts, which is dangerous because you're not supposed to be able to get in and out of Hogwarts, you know, easily. And I think he said one of them caved in when the Chamber of Secrets was destroyed, and another one caved in here, and another one caved in. But they never mentioned, like, the rest of the secret passageway. And here we learn one of them goes straight to Dumbledore's brother's room above that bar, which is like, wow, they were, like, doing secret. They, you know, they didn't get along very well, but they helped each other, you know, throughout the years.
Of correspondence, right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. That's awesome. Yeah. And I mean, just that whole aspect of it, it just opens up the greater theme in the movie, you know, which is Harry's, as he matures into an adult, something that we all learn, which is, you know, the people that we hold up as heroes and villains as kids are never these, statues, you know, are never these icons that we make them out to be. As we get older, we always learn things about them, learn weaknesses, vulnerabilities, mistakes that they've made. And then also for the people that we, you know, maybe villainize when we're kids, we learn, like he does about Snape, that no, these were living, breathing human beings with motivations and interior lives. And I think that's one of my big takeaways from the overarching series is that, you know, it's these monolithic mentor characters that he has as a kid are, except for McGonagall, who I guess just remains perfect to the end, you know, are shown to be flawed humans and complex. And like we've been talking about, you know, it's like people aren't one or the other, you know, they're a little bit of both. So that's something I really like. And I like that, you know, his brother knows about Dumbledore's dark side, has experienced it, but didn't turn his back on him entirely, but is still, you know, put off by Harry's kind of, you know, idolism of him, I guess.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, and that the whole Ariana thing is what split them apart, and so that's kind of the focal point of why there's this tension between them. And I think there was one thing, I think he broke Dumbledore's nose at somebody's funeral. I can't remember. That's in a mention, like in the first part of the book or something. So like the last time they saw each other, there was like a fist fight on like a one-sided fist fight or something. But, yeah, they really never got over that moment where their sister was murdered. But they're still on the same side, and he's still helping Dumbledore. But yeah, you make a great point about his sort of not really into Harry's, you know, idolizing or thinking so highly of. Although Harry himself is beginning to question it, because, you know, there's fake news in the wizarding world with Rita
True. Alternative facts.
Yeah. So yeah,
Kellyanne Skeeter.
There's
oh man, all the political stuff from this last one, I mean, really starting in Order of the Phoenix,
up to the ministry scenes and Deathly Hallows Part One, all of that stuff, man, is like, I'm watching it now. I'm just like, God, like, this is so therapeutic in a way to watch this all play out the way that it does. It's scary in other ways, but yeah, I mean, that's the Harry's kind of crisis of faith about Dumbledore is also something that I love so much about these last two movies, and it's probably played up a little bit more in Deathly Hallows Part One, just because they're, you know, there's more time in the wilderness to just wander and wonder what the hell's going on, and here it's more action, but it's still it's really great, and it's really nicely put together and nicely tied up, both in his experience with Snape and what he learns from that, and then his purgatory conversation or whatever the hell that is with Dumbledore. Is that pretty close to the book, that scene? I mean, it's a really well played scene, and I absolutely love the weird, you know, malformed Voldemort baby.
Yes,
the sin that Harry has cut out of himself, basically, or has been killed out of him, and he leaves in this place. I love that part, but is the overall scene close to what it is in the book? Is it given more context or information in the book? I don't know if we need more.
Yeah, it's a good chunk of it's a nice little several pages of the book that we need, because Harry is finally getting to talk to Dumbledore and ask him these questions about the things that he's learned this book. There's always a conversation with Dumbledore at the end of every single book. The first one is like, it's like a half a minute. But more and more, and it's almost one of those things you look forward to, what definitely is, because that's where you're getting more information for the next book or for the overall story. But here is it really is a great moment. He just talks about, I should have gone back and read this part, but he talks about just his life back then, you know, what he was going through, and he was like, you know, I had these aspirations for greatness, and I was, you know, I thought so highly of Gellert Grindelwald, and that was my weakness. He vowed to never put himself in a position of that sort of power again, and that's why he was headmaster of Hogwarts, and he could have been the Minister of Magic for the rest of his life, probably, if people wanted him to. But so you get a lot of these, and very, very more personal conversation, not just stuff like that. And I actually saw that little baby Voldemort, and we were in London at the studio. It kind of just moves.
Oh, I thought in the train station. I thought maybe like in a train station under the bench.
Yeah. No, I just kept my head down and walked. But that's a cool part, because it looks just like the baby that Voldemort was before he got in this adult human form again.
Yeah.
Which is actually the piece of the soul that was, as you said, cut out of Harry, which answered a long time, well, I guess 2 years when we heard of Horcruxes, ever since the second, the sixth book was released, that the theories were flying on what are the Horcruxes that we don't know about, where are they hidden, and one of the main themes was that Harry is a Horcrux, and there was either Harry is a Horcrux or no, Harry is not a Horcrux, and what do we get? We get something in between. There was a Horcrux attached to Harry, that only Voldemort could have destroyed at that point. And that's the only reason Harry survived, is because Voldemort attempted to kill him again, and it destroyed Voldemort's own soul in doing that. So, and then you've got like two Horcruxes left, and they're forced to go to Hogwarts because they know Voldemort's going there. But there's still two Horcruxes left to find. And that's what's crazy. It's like, you know, oh, no, what are we going to do? We have to go help our friends in our school. But the other Horcrux was there. And he has that conversation with a ghost that's mentioned definitely in the first and second book. And as the books progress, the ghosts are mentioned less and less.
But they're still mentioned. They don't just have, like, you know, they're not a part of as much of the scenes. But, yeah, the way that the diadem played out and everything was pretty cool. Or at least finding the next
Horcrux. Yeah, and it keeps all of that stuff going really well. I absolutely love the whole, you know, Harry being a Horcrux or kind of one or having one in him, just because I mean, I think that's just a really great narrative tool, and I think that it mirrors so many other, you know, literary traditions. But also the I remember when I, like, right before I was leaving work to go see this movie, I had done a pretty good job not letting it get spoiled for me, and I looked at Facebook, and somebody said, spoilers, Harry is Voldemort. And they posted it as a joke. But in the moment, I was like, what? Like, I know that's a joke, but...
Yeah, no, it totally messes with your
and
mind.
Then, like, as the movie played out, I was like, It was totally a joke. It wasn't like a total spoiler, but it was kind of a spoiler, you know,
a little
like
bit.
Kind of. It did,
oh yeah.
Yeah, you know, and it's just like, damn it! Like, why would somebody do that to me?
That person probably had no front. Yeah, I mean,
They'd even seen it or read the books or anything.
Right.
They were just making
an
ironic joke, but
right.
not funny.
No, you know, which one was this? It was the very last. There was this movie, and we would dress up at midnight for the midnight showings. And for this particular,
sure.
the final installment, I dressed as I'm about to spoil. Obviously, you know that as Snape at his death scene. Now in the book, you had asked about how that moment plays out in the movie and how it's different in the book. Like, that plays out in some boathouse that is brand new.
Right.
That boathouse shows up in this movie. It's never been there. It's never mentioned, in the books or anything. But that's just where his death scene plays out. It actually plays out. Do you remember the that little haunted shack, sort of between Hogwarts and Hogsmeade?
Mm-hmm.
That Remus Lupin. That's one of the other secret passageways into Hogwarts. That's speaking of secret passageways. That's the other one. So Harry uses a couple of them in the very last moments of the book. But Harry goes, he crawls through there, under the Whomping Willow, into that shack, and he's looking through the hole in the wall where you go into that house from that tunnel, and there's something blocking it, and he sees it's Voldemort and Snape just chilling. That's like the headquarters of this big fight. And Voldemort mistakenly, again, thinks that it's that Snape. You know, he thought Dumbledore getting the Elder Wands from Dumbledore would give him the power. That's not true, he found. He said, you know, Snape, you killed him. So actually, you took the power of the Elder Wand from him, which is, again, not true. And Snape knows it's not true. Snape's trying to stay alive. Obviously, he doesn't want to die, but he's very, very brave. And there's absolute, but Snape is probably the third most powerful wizard behind Dumbledore and Voldemort, and Voldemort just easily like, no, I'm going to kill you now. So he creates this bubble over his, like, his upper body, and Nagini, his snake is inside it, and Nagini just, like, goes to town, eating him, killing him. Not like eating, not devouring him, just like biting the, you know, life out of him.
Striking him, yeah.
Yeah, and the snake and Voldemort leave, and Voldemort thinks by killing Snape he's slowly getting on the right track as far as how that wand lore works, but he's still wrong. And Harry jumps in the room, and he grabs him. That's before Harry realizes anything about Snape being on his side. And he grabs him, and he just looks at him, and Snape says, look at me. It's a really touching moment, because Snape wanted to look at Harry's eyes and see Lily.
Sure, yeah.
When he's always hated the fact that Harry's had Lily, his mother's eyes, because he was in love with her. He always hated that fact. But here at the very end, he wanted to look at him one last time. And he wanted Harry to grab the memory stone. So that was in the shack. That wasn't in some new boathouse that was newly constructed.
Where Dumbledore keeps his jet skis.
Yes. Yeah. But yeah, I think it was the same. It was the same, you know, effect. Very good moment. But that's how that scene was slightly different.
Oh, that's interesting. The way Yates shoots Snape's death scene, you know, where it's just like the impact of the snake hitting him felt through the window.
Oh my god!
As Harry, that's so brutal and it's so well done. But that's obviously that's probably the most emotional scene in the whole series, or one of them. You know, I think it's right there with Hermione wiping her parents' memory. But it's so well played, and Alan Rickman just, you know, totally, he doesn't overdo it. You know, he does his thing so well. It's his best moment in the whole franchise.
This, speaking of one of the best moments in the franchise for me and Hermione, is that she was in the middle. She was kind of seen as maybe like a weaker of the actors of the three, maybe I can't remember. I believe that's how kind of a lot of the fans saw it. But she was considering not even joining.
She kind of overdid it. Say again.
She was considering quitting the series after the fourth movie. But when Harry looks at Snape's memories and he realizes what Snape had been doing this whole time. And he realized, as Snape said, you've been raising Harry as a pig for the slaughter. He's been raised to do all this and then die. Harry, that's all hitting Harry like a ton of bricks. And he realizes, okay, mm-hmm. I just have to go out there and let Voldemort kill me, and it'll be over. And when he passes Ron and Hermione, and she says, I'll go with you, that to me might be the best single like line moment in the whole movie. Because she's breaking, and this the last time these three will see all three of each other together at the same time. So that was probably one of my more touching moments for me. Do you remember that part at all?
Yeah, absolutely. It's great. She definitely brings a gravity to it that she didn't have earlier on. You can see she grew up as an actress, you know.
Totally.
We've talked our way all the way to the end here.
Yeah.
With the Elder Wand and with who, you know, with Harry having it and doing the same thing that Albus decided to do and give up power. And I feel like that's another strong takeaway from the whole thing, you know, is how we respond to power, you know, and if we're able or willing to lay it down. And I feel like that's a great final moment there at Hogwarts with the three together.
Yeah, totally. The Neville moment was a little more distinct and brief in the book, but I think better. He steps up and just cuts the head off that dang snake like it's nothing.
Yeah.
And in the movie, he kind of stumbles up, and it's still a great moment. But and then the final
it's,
battle.
It's a moment, yeah.
Yeah, it's a moment. He deserves this moment. So the final battle with as far as like Voldemort's very last, you know.
Oh yeah,
duel,
yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I shouldn't have said that. Yeah, it's great.
Well, that's where Harry and there's this duality, obviously, that they're trying to convey throughout them flying through the air back and forth, and they're almost merging and
mm-hmm.
unmerging. But in the book, I really like the book's version. They're in the Great Hall where they all eat, you know. They don't eat first. I'm not
mm-hmm.
saying they all eat and then they fight and die, but they're all in the castle is basically, this part of the castle is in ruins. They're all, the sun is setting over some of the ruins. All the people have now circled. Basically, it's Hermione and Flitwick, the tiny little professor, are fighting Voldemort, and they're like going neck and neck. Like McGonagall, these two teachers are like nuts. They're so good. And finally, Voldemort overpowers them in some way. It doesn't kill him, obviously, but he gets the upper hand, and Harry steps in, and it's just Harry and Voldemort, and it's just one spell cast, just like at the end of Goblet of Fire, that does it, and that's the end. And he just, and his body doesn't disintegrate, it just lays there and dies. And Harry does not destroy, I don't think Harry destroys the Elder Wand in the book. I think he may take it back.
Oh, wow.
Dumbledore or something. Yeah, he doesn't just destroy it, yeah. He does, but there is a very distinct moment where Harry is talking to Dumbledore's portrait in his office, and he's acknowledging he's going to fix his own wand with the Elder Wand, and he's going to put it back. And so he's definitely, they're making a point that he's not keeping this Elder Wand. He has no desire to have this wand. So, and Ron's like, "You're an idiot."
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure if that would have worked the same in a movie. You know, I feel like that would have felt like a visual setup for something later. But now it's just like, nope, it's snapped in half and at the bottom of this giant ravine. I mean, that fight you mentioned is in terms of visually, the way they're just like swooping through all the different parts of the castle and merging into one another. And it's just all just pulled off with such epic visual acuity. It's fantastic.
Yeah, and you don't see a ton of what's going on with the other fighters, but you do see their dead bodies, and I think that adds a little more weight to the fact that they're no longer with us. When you just see their dead bodies laying around.
Yeah, and it's one of those things where, like, how much of the movie can you spend, you know, just focusing on these individual skirmishes?
Well,
you have to keep the story moving along.
And that's how it happens in the book. Harry walks in, and they're all dead. It's not like you get a sense of things happening around him because she mentions it in the book, but it's all Harry. It's all Harry's perspective from here to the end. Yeah.
Well, awesome. Well, I mean, I guess the last thing to talk about is the denouement of the kids all grown up as miserable looking 36, 7 year olds, right? 20 years later, something like that.
19 years later. So,
I remember this striking me really oddly the first time I watched it, but it's like, well, I don't know how else I would have preferred them to do it. You know, obviously they can't cast other actors. Thank God they didn't use digital technology. They just kind of did it the old fashioned way. And I think for the most part, they pull it off. I feel like Ginny's hair is a little bit much. She's got like a Jackie O kind of thing going on.
Yeah. Is she channeling Jackie
but
O?
But overall, like, maybe. So how did this hit you? Like, in terms of story, in terms of reflection of the book, but also just technically how they pulled it off.
So reading the book, it was like, this is over. Here's just what happens later. Just, you know, here's a snippet of what their lives end up being like, which I'm glad she did that. I think the readers deserve that because that's a decade of their lives were invested into this. And I thought it was a nice little moment. You see who all the children they have and how they interact with each other and their cousins and, you know, but they, in the movie, it was just like, it was really fun. It was, everyone's kind of anticipating this moment. And again, I think the way Ron looks got a little bit of a laugh. Cause not only does he have like this dad bod, but he does not care that he has one. And he's just back there looking at what's happening, like almost like Rupert Grint is like looking like that on purpose. Like, it's almost like he's so aware of that fact and he's just trying to really, really do it. You know what I mean? So once again, a Ron transformation gets a little chuckle in the theater. I think Ginny's just kind of I could do away with that whole thing. But the actress is just kind of, we haven't talked about her, have we? Yeah, she's just kind of nothing.
Yeah, it's tough. It's tough. She did not grow to be the most charismatic screen presence, I think is the best way to put it. But I think especially in Half-Blood Prince. I think she does a pretty good job. But yeah, it's one of those things where you cast somebody when they're a kid and then they grow into it. And I appreciate that they stuck with it, you know, but terms of conviction, like the moment in this movie where, you know, like they have the I love you moment, but they don't actually say it. And she kind of says, I know. And then they kind of go do their separate things. I feel like that, again, that's like, there's something, she underplays that, you know, I feel like that there's, that's not a Harrison Ford, Carrie Fisher moment. You know, she's not Carrie Fisher in terms of pulling off that moment. But that's something you can't predict, you know, when you cast these kids as, you know, you can't predict that Daniel Radcliffe will eventually have this strange nervous tick that he does in a lot of his performances, but you know, you just hope that he uses it, you know, and he's an actor and she's an actor. So I feel like it's not a huge detriment, but it's definitely, I mean, I guess it's worth touching upon.
Yeah. And one thing that really, from the movie for that scene that really got me the most is the theme that the score ended on. The final moment of that movie ended on the, I think it's called Leaving Hogwarts. It's rampant throughout the early films. It's a John Williams, it's one of the John Williams original compositions, but Alexander Desplat, I don't even think that's in the score of the soundtrack, but that moment he ends the whole thing on something John Williams wrote, and he had been doing his own original themes the last two movies, and they're all great. I mean, he's the second best composer for these films, but he ends it on that really great, like, you talk about a piece of music that you hear and it just brings back all these memories. I think that's the point.
Yeah.
I think he realized that is that for so many people, and he ends it's the very last thing before it cuts to black, and it's great.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, it's like one of those things where it's kind of like you have to get away from it for a while to make it special again. You know, if you had been hearing these cues for the last three movies over and over and over again, it wouldn't feel that monumental when you hear it again. So I like that touch, and I agree with you that Desplat is you know, the kind of runner up to the champ of the series in terms of music. However, I think maybe next week we should get back on the phone and do our rankings and do just kind of like general cleanup talk. So we can like talk about the franchise overall. I just realized that there's like so many little things that I think would be fun to talk about. And I don't want to bury them in this one.
Yeah, I'll draw some things.
We can make lists.
Yeah, totally.
Lists. But yeah, I mean, overall, I totally agree with you that the movie needed this kind of postscript because you've spent eight movies with these people. You know, it's like, I remember when Return of the King came out, everybody complained about all the endings there. And it's like, well, yeah, because we just spent like 9 hours with these characters and we want some falling action. Like in a book, nobody would blink an eye at it. But in a movie, everybody wants it to end with a hard cut to the credits.
Yeah.
So I appreciate that about it, and I like it. I think it's a great approach, and I agree with you that final moment just takes it right back to the magical kind of approach to the first few movies.
For more Film Nerds Unlimited, go to filmnerds.com or find us on Facebook and Twitter. If you like what you hear, rate and review our podcast on iTunes. Keep an eye out for the next issue of Film Nerds Unlimited, coming soon.